The headlines, the Taliban accused the U.S. of violating a peace deal between the two sides after the Pentagon said the group failed to comply with the agreement. Police use force as clashes erupt between opponents and supporters of a major farmers' protest that has disrupted the Indian capital for more than 8 weeks. And also, Hungary becomes the first EU member to approve the Chinese-made Sinopharm COVID-19 vaccine as a shortfall in jabs pushes the bloc's vaccination drive to a crisis point. Hello and welcome, everybody. Afghanistan's Taliban have accused the United States of violating last year's peace agreement between the militant group and Washington. A Taliban spokesman said the U.S. is bombarding civilians, houses, and villages in Afghanistan. The group said these are not just violation of the agreement, but human rights as well. The reaction comes hours after Washington blamed the militant group for not meeting its commitments under the deal.
I said the Taliban are not meeting their commitments to reduce violence and to renounce their ties to Al-Qaeda. They are not meeting their commitments. And as long as they're not meeting their commitments, it's going to be difficult for anybody at that negotiating table to meet their commitments. In fact, it wouldn't be the wise course.
The Pentagon said it's rather very hard to see a way forward for a negotiated settlement if the Taliban do not fulfill their obligations. In February 2020, the U.S. struck an accord with the group without including the Afghan government. Under the agreement, Washington vowed to withdraw U.S. forces from Afghanistan. In return, the Taliban agreed to not allow extremists to operate from the country and give some security guarantees nearly 1 year after the deal. Neither the Taliban nor the U.S. have complied with the terms of the agreement. The Afghan government has accused the Taliban of stalling peace talks in the Qatari capital, Doha. Kabul has also threatened it will intensify attacks on Taliban positions if the militant group does not stop attacking civilians. Amin Alini reports.
Almost 3 months have passed since the beginning of the intra-Afghan talks in Qatari capital, Doha. The negotiating team of the Afghan government accuses the Taliban of foot-dragging, but the militant group rejects such allegation.
The negotiating team of the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan is fully ready for talks, but the Taliban side has ignored to attend the meetings over the past 10 days under the pretext of being busy with their own meetings.
In the meantime, this top army official, who usually spends much of his time in front lines, also accuses the Taliban of expanding their attacks amid condemnations by the Afghan people and international bodies like the United Nations. That is why officials here warn that Afghan troops may intensify their attacks on the Taliban if they continue targeting civilians.
Our message to the Taliban is to either grab the current opportunity to bring peace or stop targeting civilians. Otherwise, we will pound their positions across the country and we will kill them one by one.
Despite all ifs and buts regarding the Afghan peace process, what war-weary Afghans want is lasting peace and an opportunity to forget about war, bloodshed and misery they have been suffering for over the last four decades.
We are tired of war. We have one wish, that is to see calm and security in our country. We don't care about either the government or the Taliban, but we want an immediate silence of guns here.
So far, many regional and international players, mainly the U.S., have declared their full readiness to support any move toward bringing peace to the country.
This comes as many here believe the Afghan peace process has now turned into a good pretext for some local and international players. This is because such a matter allows them to further interfere in Afghanistan's affairs and follow their own interests in this wounded land. Syed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
The Pentagon has reaffirmed its support to Taiwan's self-defense after China said independence from the island means war.
The department sees no reason why tensions over Taiwan need to lead to anything like confrontation. And so we find that comment unfortunate and certainly not commensurate with our intentions to meet our obligations under the Taiwan Relations Act.
The remarks were the first by President Joe Biden's military about China-Taiwan tensions since he took office last week. Those tensions have been escalating in the past months. As the U.S. increased support to Taiwan, the support included deals selling arms to the self-ruled island. China considers Taiwan as part of its territory and is opposed to U.S. support for it. China sees U.S. measures as a violation of One China policy and interference in its internal affairs. Taiwan wants independence from China. The United States and South Korea plan to carry out joint military exercises this spring, drawing international calls for the drills to be suspended. Nearly 400 activist organizations in South Korea and around the world signed a joint statement calling on new U.S. President Joe Biden to suspend the exercises, even as military officials in Seoul and Washington suggested the maneuvers would go ahead. Frank Smith reports from Seoul.
Joint military drills involving the U.S. and South Korea are scheduled to go ahead this spring, says South Korea's Minister of Defense and military officials under U.S. President Joe Biden. But nearly 400 NGOs around the world have signed a joint statement calling for the drills to be scrapped in the hopes of improving relations with North Korea and promoting a lasting peace. The annual exercises, some of which are computer-simulated war games, are viewed by Pyongyang as a threat and a rehearsal for invasion.
The joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises have been suspended before in the early 1990s as Washington sought to improve relations with Pyongyang. Previous U.S. President Donald Trump also scaled back the drills following his first summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in 2018.
The North's Kim then pledged to suspend nuclear and long-range missile testing, with subsequent meetings between Kim and Trump failing to yield results or much for North Korea in return for its moratorium. U.S.-led sanctions against Pyongyang remain in place. South Korea keeps buying more advanced U.S. weapons, and now more military exercises are planned. Some activists view the war drills as counterproductive.
These South Korea-U.S. joint exercises fail to contribute to maintaining peace. Rather, it has been conducted in a way that threatens peace on the Korean Peninsula. It's now even more important because it's the beginning of the new Biden government in the United States and what signals can give to North Korea at this point.
North Korea has continued developing other military technologies, introducing a submarine-launched ballistic missile at a recent military parade. While seemingly committed to the drills, new U.S. officials have said they're reviewing North Korea policy, as experts call on Pyongyang to be patient. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Indian police have used force to break up clashes between protesting farmers and a rival group shouting anti-farmer slogans near the capital, New Delhi. Police used tear gas and batons to disperse protesters. Farmers' leaders, however, accuse the police of instigating skirmishes to turn sentiment against them. Farmers are holding protest rallies and sit-ins over the past 4 months to oppose new farm laws. They also held a tractor rally on the country's Republic Day that turned violent, leaving one person dead and hundreds injured. The farmers want the government repeal the legislation, arguing it would leave them at the mercy of big corporations. The government claims the measure is aimed at boosting rural incomes. Several rounds of talks between the two sides have failed to make a breakthrough. Well, Sweden has reported 2,400 new coronavirus cases and 71 additional fatalities from the disease. That raises the country's overall infections to nearly 567,000 and its death toll closer to 12,000. Sweden's death toll per capita is several times higher than that of its Nordic neighbors. The country has shunned a lockdown throughout the pandemic. Meanwhile, Hungary has become the first EU member to approve the Chinese-made Sinopharm COVID-19 vaccine. Budapest plans to order 500,000 doses of the jab for delivery in February. Prime Minister Viktor Orban said he would choose the vaccine for his own inoculation. Last week, Hungary also approved Russia's Sputnik V vaccine, becoming the first EU member to do so as well. It said it agreed to buy 2 million doses of the jab. And the European Union has agreed on the new coronavirus travel curbs as the continent is struggling with the virus and its new variants. EU member states' ambassadors to Brussels approved a new map of coronavirus danger zones across the bloc, allowing authorities to impose stricter travel restrictions. Earlier, EU governments also agreed that COVID hotspots would be labeled as, quote, dark red zones to discourage all non-essential travel. The moves to tighten borders came as some European countries, including Britain and Belgium, have already introduced new travel restrictions aimed at curbing the spread of new strains of the virus. On Friday, the British government also banned direct passenger flights from the United Arab Emirates because of worries over the spread of a more contagious and potentially vaccine-resistant COVID variant. Bangladesh has sent more Rohingya refugees to a remote island in the country's south. The third phase of the relocation comes despite opposition from rights groups that have expressed concerns over the living conditions on the island in the Bay of Bengal. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed the issue in depth with our guests.
Welcome to News Review. Bangladesh has sent a new batch of Rohingya Muslim refugees to a remote island in the Bay of Bengal, despite calls to stop the relocation. A Bangladeshi naval official says more than 1,700 refugees will arrive on Bahasanchar Island on Friday. They will join around 3,500 refugees already sent there. Dhaka says it is only moving people who are willing to leave their current overcrowded camps. However, rights groups say the refugees have been forced to leave. The UN has also criticized the relocation. It says it has not been allowed to evaluate conditions at the island. Rohingya Muslims are from Myanmar. Hundreds of thousands of them took refuge in Bangladesh in 2017 to flee a crackdown at home. Gentlemen, it's good to have you with us. Out of Frankfurt, please introduce yourself once for us and tell us what you think about this recent development.
Yeah, my name is Nate Sandway. It is Burmese name. Most of the Rohingya have the Arabic name, but I have both Burmese and this Rohingya name.
Excellent.
So I'm based in Frankfurt. I'm a co-founder of Free Rohingya Coalition. So today, Tadbash, as you know, that they have transported 1,778. Previously, they have transported 3,446 in two batches. So they are going to transport tomorrow as a fourth batch. I think that also will be around 2,000. So they are moving them very fastly. Within this month, this is the third batch, and maybe tomorrow.
What's your position on this, sir? What's your position on this?
My position is in the first batch, you know, a lot of people contact me and they are saying that they are going there against their will. But from the second batch, I'm not hearing this anymore because people realize that they can avoid this because Bangladesh has already built their accommodation there. So at least 100,000 will be transported. And also, there is no one, you know, can stop this relocation. That is why, you know, the refugees are being vulnerable. They have no chance to refuse to go there. You know, that is the reason now they are going there quietly. They are saying they are going there by own will. Mm-hmm. So since 3,500 already there, they are calling their relative, their loved one to join there. You know, they, at least you know. The, of course, you know, if I tell you the truth, their living, their accommodation is much better than the cost of bazaar camp. So they are thinking, you know, it's better to live there. So from my,
you know, I'm very surprised, Naiswan Lin, because if the situation is better than the camps that they are already in, why is it that they have to be sent against their will?
Yes, because you know that the refugee, they don't really want to live there in the remote island because you know it is the they will be threatened by the cyclone and also it is cloud to probe. And also it is very far from the mainland. They will not have the chance to go back to the mainland. They have so many concerns, but they can refuse now, you know. So since there is no one to, take their side and they are in the Bangladesh soil and they can avoid. They are going there, you know. So if they refuse and if they say something, you know, they will be in trouble. You know, what they are thinking is that, sure. That is why they are going there quietly. Mm-hmm. So, but you know, the most important is, you know, they are there. There is enough space for the education, healthcare.
Okay. Let's get some reaction from Sami Hamdi in London. Sami, go ahead.
I think Bangladesh has made it clear from the start that it's been very reluctant to receive the Rohingya. You'll remember in the beginning of the exodus of the Rohingya from Myanmar, we saw Bangladesh at one point even try to close the border. We saw it deploy troops in order to try to prevent the Rohingya from arriving. We saw Bangladesh assert that they should go elsewhere. Since then, as a result of the immense pressure, you feel in Bangladesh that there is this reluctance, that it's a burden to look after the Rohingya, and that's been compounded by a lack of international movement from the international community to provide the necessary relief from Rohingya and to pressure in any meaningful way Myanmar. We've seen pressure on Myanmar, but not in a meaningful way. And that's one of the greatest issues that the Rohingya have. And I agree with the honorable guest when he says that the problem that the Rohingya have is that if they don't move to the island, they feel they will be in trouble, because the reality is that they don't have a choice. Their views and their perspectives are irrelevant. What Bangladesh is doing essentially is giving them an island that it would not accept Bengalis to move to. And the reality is that human rights groups have lamented that this island has been submerged in previous times by monsoon. Despite the fact there are flood banks, it is not necessarily safe, that many Rohingya are moving there against their will. But this is about Bangladesh essentially trying to remove the Rohingya from Bengali society. But the biggest problem is what this means for the wider issue of the Rohingya plight, which is that given the lack of pressure on the Myanmar government, and given that Bangladesh clearly doesn't want to look after refugees, and given that the UN hasn't provided any meaningful resolution to the crisis, what this means is that what Bangladesh is doing is giving them an island and essentially shelving the problem. Myanmar will say they're living now with their houses in the island. We don't want anything to do with them. Bangladesh will say it's not my responsibility. And that's the disaster, in that the Rohingya, despite the fact that they have been ethnically targeted because of their ethnicity, despite the fact they've been driven out from their homes violently and forcefully, we are still not seeing any effective action. Yeah. And even to this day, they remain abandoned to such an extent that Bangladesh believes that it's okay to stick them on some remote island.
You mentioned the lack of attention to what the Myanmaris have done. Why isn't there that leverage that you think should have existed from 2017, you know, when the plight began? Why is it that nobody really pressures Myanmar?
States do not act in altruistic manner. The reality is that the groups are only designated terrorist groups if Iran or Russia or China are backing them. It's all about self-interest, all about the geopolitical dynamics that quite simply do not exist in the Myanmar issue. There's no Russia, there's no China, there's no Iran, there's no necessary interest from the U.S. It's not willing
and there's
to
no
exert
human rights
itself
issue,
and military
then.
Power for the sake of a few Muslim refugees. And there are no Muslim countries that are ready to upset the international order by taking any real action.
Thank you. Yeah. Understandably. Yeah. That's Sami Hamdi, editor-in-chief at the International Interest out of London. I also had the pleasure of hosting Mr. Nay San Luen. He's the coordinator of Free Rohingya Coalition. I hope I got your name right this time, sir, out of Frankfurt. Thank you very, very much, gentlemen, for discussing this issue with me. And thank you for staying tuned.
That brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Bye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Limelight. Surveying the widespread and devastating wreckage the coronavirus pandemic has inflicted on the world economy over the past 9 months, the United Nations Labour Agency estimated recently that the COVID-19 crisis caused a loss of 8.8% of global working hours in 2020, the equivalent of 255 million full-time jobs. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jake Johnson, writer. This article is published under the heading, UN Labor Agency says, Pandemic job losses four times higher than after 2009 financial collapse. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Surveying the widespread and devastating wreckage the coronavirus pandemic has inflicted on the world economy over the past 9 months, the United Nations Labour Agency estimated recently that the COVID-19 crisis caused a loss of 8.8% of global working hours in 2020, the equivalent of 255 million full-time jobs. That figure, according to the International Labour Organization's latest report, is approximately four times greater than the number of jobs lost during the 2009 global financial crisis, with the pain felt disproportionately by workers in the service industry and other typically low-wage sectors of the economy. This has been the most severe crisis for the world of work since the Great Depression of 1930s, ILO Director General Guy Ryder told the Associated Press. Its impact is far greater than that of the global financial crisis of 2009. While expressing cautious optimism about the possibility of a strong recovery in the latter half of 2021 as vaccination efforts ramp up, the ILO report warns that the global economy is still facing high levels of uncertainty, and there is a risk that the recovery will be uneven if governments don't provide sufficient support for those harmed by ongoing mass layoffs and the international community fails to assist developing nations. Inequality is likely to further increase as a result of the type of job losses generated by the crisis, the report states. In the United States and the United Kingdom, for instance, significant job losses occurred at the lower end of the labor income distribution, while high-paid jobs were left largely intact. The crisis has had particularly devastating effects on many vulnerable population groups and sectors around the globe. The analysis continues. Young people, women, the low-paid, and low-skilled workers have less potential to achieve recovery quickly, and the risk of long-term scarring and detachment from the labor market is all too real. In order to facilitate a sustainable and equitable recovery from the pandemic, which has killed more than 2 million people across the globe, the report recommends macroeconomic policies to remain accommodative in 2021 and beyond, including fiscal stimulus where possible and measures to support incomes and promote investment. Targeted measures to reach women, young people, low-skilled and low-paid workers, and other hard-hit groups. International support for low- and middle-income countries, which have fewer financial resources to roll out vaccines and promote economic and employment recovery. Focusing support on the hardest-hit sectors while creating jobs in fast-growing ones, and social dialogue to implement the recovery strategies necessary to create more inclusive, fair, and sustainable economies. The signs of recovery we see are encouraging, but they are fragile and highly uncertain, and we must remember that no country or group can recover alone, Ryder said in a statement. We are at a fork in the road. One path leads to an uneven, unsustainable recovery with growing inequality and instability, and the prospect of more crises. The other focuses on a human-centered recovery for building back better, prioritizing employment, income, and social protection, workers' rights, and social dialogue. If we want a lasting, sustainable, and inclusive recovery, Ryder said, this is the path policymakers must commit to.
Iran Today.
The world is going on to 100 million coronavirus cases with about 55 million recoveries. There have been over 2 million deaths. Iran is one of the hard-hit spots on the globe with 10 cities in the red. However, its toll has been reduced to a fraction of what it was. As of 25th January 2021, there were 1.37 million registered COVID-positive cases in Iran. Of these, there were 1.16 million recoveries and 57,294 deaths.
U.S. sanctions and a strained economy have meant less than average fiscal space and therefore a partially haphazard set of restrictive protocols in place. It's a wonder how Iran has managed to bring its coronavirus death toll down to a fraction of what it was. That's from 400-500 deaths a day to 70-80 plus deaths a day. Now, why and how has Iran set itself on this steep path to survival is our question. Iran has even attempted manufacturing an anti-corona vaccine, or let's say vaccines. More to follow. Stay with me, Leila Faromarzi, on Iran Today. More than 8 Iranian companies and universities are currently working on a COVID-19 vaccine. And Iran launched human trials of a first domestic COVID-19 vaccine candidate of its own late in December. But vaccine production or administering is not the primarily important step in corona control. Dr. Abul Ghasemi, Dean of Baghiatullah University, explains.
Control of the disease. هنوز
Controlling the disease and breaking the virus transmission chain is the most important task we can do to take the outbreak under control, which has several requirements that must be met. The most significant of which is that people observe social distancing, using face masks, and adhering to public health guidelines. Thankfully, measures have been taken in the country in the past few months that have raised awareness amongst the people, and as a result, the new wave of the disease was brought under control.
I said earlier that restrictive measures had been haphazard. Well, that doesn't hold for all waves of the pandemic, which is why Iran finally got results. Dr. Ghanei is a lung specialist involved with the Corona Combat Unit and bringing vaccines to fruition.
Iran's past protocols in controlling the spread of the coronavirus. What would you say are the strengths and weaknesses of those protocols?
We passed the first and second waves by issuing lockdowns and preventing people from going outside their homes. But we acted smartly during the third wave by dividing cities into different zones and imposing travel restrictions based on the condition in that specific city. We monitored people's cell phones, enabling us to prevent those who had contracted the disease from traveling. The airports are now being checked, and we have been increasing the number of coronavirus tests to several thousands. Our testing capacity was dramatically increased. The combination of these measures, namely early detection, isolation, and intelligent quarantines, helped us to rein in the disease.
Iran established a National Electronic Health Record, EHR, system in which every citizen is registered with a national ID number. That helped health networks start early detection of infected cases. Afflicted citizens could thereby be isolated. The most vulnerable were prevented from referring to hospitals in cities. Rather, health teams were assigned to visit patients at home. As for prevention, impoverished suburban residents reportedly had masks distributed to them. Dr. Mardani, a specialist from Mehr, a most prominent hospital in Tehran, joined us on Skype. Do listen in.
We were able to control the disease in the country. Fortunately, the number of the cases is now very low. The number of new patients has actually reduced to a third or a quarter of what it used to be. Our hospitalization have dropped dramatically. We have closed many COVID-19 wards in university hospitals and those belonging to the Ministry of Health and the Army. Our ICUs, which had no empty beds to receive COVID cases, are now accepting other patients. However, some hospitals still house coronavirus-positive patients.
Iran is one of the top five manufacturers of coronavirus antigen-based rapid detection kits in the world. And it's rapidly established a decentralized laboratory testing for COVID-19. The homegrown antibody rapid test can detect coronavirus in 15 to 20 minutes, with over 85% detection power, which is higher than PCR tests. This country has a strong primary healthcare system, and with a production surge in a reasonable time and a multi-sectoral response to the corona crisis, it has achieved some impressive results which it hopes to sustain. On the 14th of January, Iran's COVID-19 daily death toll was reported at 81, marking a two-digit figure for 2 weeks and the lowest fatality rate in 7 months. To move on to what the future holds in store, the vaccine that is, Shafar Farmed has already cleared animal trials for its vaccine, and it aims to complete limited tests on 56 volunteers in its initial stage. Tests expected to last the month.
How does Iran's success rate rank in combating the coronavirus compared to regional states?
There are two countries that are producing vaccines in the region. One is Iran and the other Egypt. But if you have a look at the UNICEF website, Iran is the only name mentioned as a producer of COVID-19 vaccines. The country that didn't want to have a vaccine is now producing it itself. The other point is that we in the biotechnology development headquarters have supported all forms of vaccines to be developed. So we will have a variety of vaccines in the coming months, God willing.
Here's a list of the most prominent vaccines currently being made around the globe. In the top three, you see US's Pfizer vaccine and the UK's Oxford AstraZeneca, which Iran found no use for. Not even for the 150,000 Pfizer shots the U.S. wanted to donate to this country. Several reasons why. Let's hear it from Dr. Abolghasemi. His Bariatollah complex is making a vaccine of its own and treats corona patients by crisis doctors with experience in war zones.
There is a drug right now called cyclophosphamide. This drug also happens to be produced by Pfizer. You cannot find the vial of the drug in Iran. I wonder how Pfizer, which failed to provide us with cyclophosphamide because of the US sanctions, has become kind enough to give us the vaccine as a gift. This proves they're politicizing the matter. That is, they first put pressure on a nation and refuse to provide it with food and medicine, and then give out a gift to whitewash their crimes. We should not be fooled by these things. We have been accustomed to this behavior for years.
Moderna and Pfizer vaccines were never on the agenda to be purchased by Iran anyway. This is due to their high prices, transportation problems, and the need to be kept extremely cold. This is according to Mohammad Reza Zafarghandi, head of the Iranian Medical Council. Iran deems its homemade vaccine to be more reliable than many foreign-made vaccines, but it takes a long time to be approved. So this country plans to import some 2 million doses of COVID-19 vaccines from India, China, and Russia by the end of the current Iranian calendar year, beginning March the 21st.
We on the vaccine committee know that vaccines and drugs are produced differently. When buying a vaccine, you must ask the manufacturing country to produce it for your country specifically. It is not like you go on and take the vaccine from the market. Each country has its specific vaccine and with its own production number. You cannot get this vaccine from anywhere else. It is specific to that country. What the leader of the Islamic Revolution has said in his remarks was that we don't trust Britain and the United States in what they will produce when you place an order. This is a bigger issue and has nothing to do with the types of vaccines.
More than 60,000 people signed up for the Shafa-Farmet trial vaccines mid to late December. Several other Iranian vaccines are expected to clear animal trials by late February.
The vaccine that Bariatollah University of Medical Sciences worked on is a recombinant type. We hope that it will reach the human trial phase by March. We are now in the animal phase. The vaccine has been tested on monkeys and given very good results. It was previously tested on small animals such as mice, which also had very promising results. We hope to be able to successfully prepare the vaccine and pass the human trial phase.
Faring in the meantime, I leave to after a quick media review. So let's move indoors to see what other media outlets have to say. To begin the news section, let's look at Tasnim news, the coronavirus and travel bans. Iran extends coronavirus travel ban to UK. Iran has extended the suspension of flights to London over concerns about an alarming surge in the coronavirus cases and a new
COVID variant in the UK, an official said. Head of Iran's civil aviation organization, Turaj Dehfani Zangane, told IRNA that the ban on flights to and from London will remain in place until February the 18th. Iran began to halt the UK flights in December 2020 to prevent the spread of a new coronavirus strain that was first reported in Britain. Moving on, the WHO puts in a word on Iran and its corona crisis. In Middle East, COVID-19 hotspot Iran, WHO walks the talk. An obstacle that Iran has had to face in its COVID-19 response is unilateral economic sanctions, which are also affecting the health sector, even before the epidemic started. While the WHO country office, together with other agencies of the UN country team, are supporting the Ministry of Health and Medical Education to mitigate the impact, even the timely implementation of more than $80 million, which the country office has received for COVID-19 emergency procurement for life-saving medical and laboratory equipment from a range of different donor countries and the Ministry of Health, is made more difficult under such conditions, in addition to the anyhow stressed global market conditions with much higher demands than supplies. WHO supports the country by directly communicating with suppliers and purchasing state-of-the-art equipment and essential supplies on the global market. Tehran Times points to the reliability of Western vaccines. Western COVID-19 vaccines, an iron fist in a velvet glove? According to the World Health Organization, WHO, currently more than 230 pharmaceutical companies around the globe are working to develop the corona vaccine. And more than 30 million vaccine doses have already been administered in 47 mostly high-income countries. Meanwhile, four drug giants have grabbed the headlines: Pfizer, BioNTech, Moderna, and Oxford, as well as fierce controversy surrounding the safety of their products, possible adverse effects, and efficacy, let alone some lawsuits against them due to their products. As stated by the Wall Street Journal, France now meets some of the world's highest skepticism rates, with only around 422,000 people receiving the vaccine in more than 3 weeks since European regulators authorized the drug, far behind most other developed nations. Also, approximately 4 out of 10 Americans say they would definitely or probably not get a vaccine, according to a Pew Research Center survey of 12,648 U.S. adults from November the 18th to 29th, 2020. Thanks for staying with me. Back to our own narrative now. Still in waiting, Iran reached an agreement to pay for 16.8 million doses of vaccines from COVAX using its central bank's funds in South Korea. $7 billion, that is. But a day later, it decided against that for fear its money would be seized by U.S. intermediary banks. Instead, Iran attempted buying 1 million doses of a vaccine from China, said Karim Hemmati, the head of the Iranian Red Crescent Society. COVAX, by the way, is a global initiative under the World Health Organization, WHO, that aims to ensure equitable access to vaccines for all countries. Now, reports came out in early to mid-January on an inspiring joint effort that Iran and Cuba had begun trials of a joint COVID-19 vaccine. The two countries, both of which are suffering illegal U.S. sanctions, decided on a little self-help to turn the tables round. And Cuba's Soberana O2, the most advanced of Cuba's four vaccine candidates, was set to be developed in cooperation between Cuba's Finlay Vaccine Institute and Iran's Pasteur Institute. The last stage of clinical trials of the Cuban vaccine are to be carried out in Iran. Technology transfer and joint production were preconditions for allowing human testing in this country.
The vaccine Iran and Cuba are working on has a feature called recombinant DNA technology. We first collaborated with Cuba about 25 to 26 years ago to transfer the technology to make the hepatitis B vaccine. Since 1993, all people born in the Islamic Republic of Iran have been vaccinated against hepatitis B free of charge. Now, this Cuban vaccine, in collaboration with the Pasteur Institute, has the same DNA recombinant technology, which will undergo clinical trials in the near future, God willing.
Amid concerns over a fourth wave of the pandemic, Iran's race for a homegrown vaccine continues. In the meantime, however, it plans to carry out a national anti-COVID-19 vaccination scheme in February with imported vaccines as well as homegrown ones. The question is, in what order? Iran has a four-phase plan in place to prioritize vulnerable groups. The Corona Combat Headquarters spokesperson stressed, vaccination will begin before year-end in four phases. The first two phases of which will reduce the death toll. Iran has made software connected to the Unified Health Network. It will pinpoint exactly how many vulnerable groups exist in each province and city, and how many vaccines they must receive. Another software program has also been developed for people to enter in their age, occupation, and background illness to see in which phase they can get their jab.
After developing the vaccine, you'll get to the mass production phase. We anticipated this and investigated the facilities we can use in the country to be able to mass produce the vaccine. There's a vaccine which we can make large numbers of and make it available to the public by June. We also believe that we can prepare more than 1.5 million doses per month of the recombinant DNA vaccine.
The first phase will see the following groups vaccinated: health workers in direct contact with the corona infected, care home workers, chemical warfare victims, and war veterans with respiratory or over 50% damage. Also, undertakers and the mentally and physically frail are in the phase one category, which covers some 1,300,000 people.
We are a country where we vaccinated against polio in a way that the world did not believe, when we managed to inoculate everyone in 1 month. In other countries, a maximum of 700,000 people are vaccinated per week. If we want to proceed at the same rate in Iran, 10 million people could take the jabs, which is far fewer than the 80 million people living in Iran.
Phase 2 is to cover other high-risk groups, such as over 65-year-olds and those with background illnesses from age 16 to 64. Phase 1 and 2 vaccinations are to reduce the death rate, but with phases 3 and 4, hopes are that the spread of the virus will come to a halt. The viral chain will be broken, that is.
Fortunately, Iran was introduced as a model in the Middle East in terms of transparency of case reports in the last meeting of the World Health Organization in the Eastern Mediterranean region. I'm confident that cases in the UAE, Saudi Arabia, and countries including Iraq and Afghanistan are much more than in Iran. But either some of these countries, like Iraq and Afghanistan, lack the ability and facilities to accurately detect and report cases, or some like Iran's southern neighbors in the Persian Gulf, who have the capabilities, intentionally choose not to announce the data.
As for phase three, that is to cover densely populated centers such as barracks, prisons, winter shelters for the homeless, immigrant camps, transportation personnel, teachers, bank employees, and anyone at lower risk than the phase two group. Finally, phase four will cover the general population. Although Iran has a good health network, it has furthermore foreseen vaccination stops in 400 hospitals, as well as equipping 4,000 local health centers and homes for an evening shift and vaccinations. It all sounds so easy in words, but the path to reducing the death toll and attempting a vaccine has been a rocky road. Our doctors tell of some challenges the country and its medical workers faced.
Imposing restrictions poses enormous challenges in any society. The first problem that arises is economic issues. When you order that the markets must close at 6 p.m., the shopkeeper may not be able to even afford the rent. According to the official information published by the Statistical Center of Iran, gathered from across the country, people's main sources of income over the past year were either from renting their houses or interests they received on their bank deposits. That is, most businesses have run into problems in the past year. Unfortunately, the government has been unable to pay for damages inflicted on Iranian families due to the sanctions.
Another challenge with imposing restrictions that Dr. Mardani told us of was that a lot of people took the disease too lightly and had it spread in their families. In hospitals, we got to see families who took precautions for 8 months, he said, then suddenly thought, what the hell, and took off for Mashhad City. And, well, they all caught COVID-19. Thank God for the medical front. I asked how Iran had managed to replicate secret formulas in devising its own medicine.
Our universities, pharmacy faculties, and biotechnology systems that were developed after the Islamic Revolution are unique. We may be amongst the top 10 countries in the world in terms of drugs and drug development, especially biological drugs. So we do not need to have access to a secret formulation. Many of these are now shared in the world. It's not like the formulations are being kept a secret. When a drug is made, it has a formulation that our scientists can find and access. So far, we have done this like other countries. The Indians and Chinese have done the same.
Moving forward isn't necessitated by modern technology. In bringing the past forth to the rescue, Iran decided to dip into its ancient tradition of herbal cure, this time for a very new disease. And 85 research projects on traditional herbal medicine were developed to help contain the coronavirus pandemic in this country. Arman Zargaran, an advisor to the Traditional Medicine Office of the Ministry of Health, said that some of these medicinal herbs were even able to halve the hospitalization period and help patients recover faster. Also, to reduce the burden of the disease, a center offering traditional medicine services to coronavirus patients was inaugurated in Tehran's Shahid Behesht University of Medical Sciences. This happened early in November. That's it for today. Thanks from the whole team. Do remember to tune in again at the same times next week and each week after. For now, I bid you farewell with well wishes and high hopes for coronavirus patients now that vaccines are lining up.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.